Rich versus Commonwealth, Kenneth E. Martindale Appellate Counsel, Christopher P. Chandel, Assistant Attorney General Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed. Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Kevin Martindale. I represent Breonna Rich in this appeal, and I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
This case involves a very unfortunate collision between an automobile driven by the appellant Breonna Rich and an unlit reflectorless motorized wheelchair that was occupied at the time by a highly intoxicated man who was eating something, wearing camouflage pants, and was last seen meandering in the roadway in his device.
Is the point of that to imply that the victim had contributory negligence?
Contributory negligence does not apply in a criminal case.
Then why do all those facts factor into this?
Because you have to determine proximate cause.
You didn't look at the victim and say, oh, I couldn't see him because of his camouflage.
The key here is there has to be a determination of what caused this accident for the purposes of the first assignment of error. And the last thing that anybody can say with regard to Mr. Costello came from the witness, Deja Young. And what she explained is that she was driving down the road well below the speed limit, approximately half the speed limit, came upon him, was very concerned by what she saw. He appeared to be intoxicated or otherwise, had problems. He looked like he was eating something. He was meandering around the road. She was concerned he might get run over. And then there was a period of time after she drives away. She tried to speak to him, but he was unresponsive. She drives away. She initially said a couple of seconds later there was an accident. Then she clarified and said maybe 30 seconds or something. But there's some period of time where no one knows what this individual did. And, in fact, the investigating officer testified that he could not say and that it's possible that the man turned in at the last moment.
So right. If it's possible that there was an intervening cause that breaks the chain, that's not a win. There's got to be reasonable doubt that that actually occurred.
Well, it's according to the cases, it is incumbent upon a plaintiff in a civil case or the Commonwealth in a criminal case to show who, what, when, why, how. You have to prove what happened in the collision. And so the question is, what path did Mr. Costello take? Did he go backwards at any point? Did he go left, right, go in a circle? Did he do it at the 15-second mark? Did he do it in 30 seconds? Or was it 3 seconds? We don't know. If I asked every justice of this court to take out a piece of paper and draw a line showing the path that was traveled by this individual who was at an angle pointed southeast when last seen and was determined to have been hit pointing due south, no one would be able to agree on what path he took.
And a drunk driver with sleep deprivation who's getting a cigarette lit by a passenger hits somebody. And you say that the plaintiff in a civil case or the Commonwealth in a criminal case has to produce evidence that the person that was hit by the drunk driver wasn't doing handstands or doing something unforeseeable in the middle of the road?
According to the cases, and I will concede that most of the cases are older and most of them are civil and took away money verdicts, but according to the cases, it is still the burden of a party complaining about how an accident occurred, whether it's the Commonwealth or a plaintiff, to show how the collision occurred. And supposition and conjecture built on conjecture is not enough. And
why doesn't Exhibit 20 show how the accident occurred? The hover round is in front of her vehicle and the two collide.
That shows where it occurred. What it doesn't show is how it occurred.
It shows, why doesn't it show how it occurred? Car, hover around, collide.
That much is shown. The question is, how did he get there? If he inserted himself into her lane of travel in a quick fashion, coming from somewhere completely unanticipated, that would make his driving of his motorized device the proximate cause, the sole intervening proximate cause of this collision. And the only evidence as to what she did is the statement that she gave to the police, where she was driving below the speed limit, admittedly looked away for a second, a very brief moment, as determined by the judge. The judge actually challenged the Commonwealth on that and said that I haven't heard any evidence to contradict that she looked down briefly to the right. So we know that she looked down briefly to the right. She's driving below the speed limit. And she said to the police that she looked up in time to see him slam on the brakes, but not enough time to avoid hitting him. That's her explanation. Now, of course, the court doesn't have to accept every word that a defendant would have said to the police. I understand that. But the question remains, how did Mr. Costello get there? How quickly did he move? How fast does a hover-around vehicle go anyway? Did he go around in a circle quickly? Did he initially, when he was at the angle, did he travel due east and then suddenly dart to the right and end up in front of her? We don't know. And it is not incumbent upon the defense to disprove this causation. It's incumbent upon the Commonwealth to prove how the accident occurred, every part of it. And that simply didn't happen based on this record, and it's understandable how it didn't happen.
So if that thesis were right, then in every case where a drunk driver runs over a pedestrian, the plaintiff would have to prove that the pedestrian didn't pole vault into the middle of the road or parachute into the middle of the road or sprint into the middle of the road. There'd have to be some proof that none of those hypotheticals occurred. Because that's the logical limits of what you're saying, it seems to me.
Well, if you look, for example, at the Hoffner case decided by this court in 1984, the administrator of the estate bore the burden of proving how, when, or why her son came to be lying prone in the roadway. The driver didn't even know what he had hit, and he ran over a 220-pound man, or young man. He was 17 years old at the time. And the court said that because the administratrix of the estate could not show the how, when, or why her son came to be lying prone in the roadway, there could be no recovery. Now, that's a person who's not moving. And the most fair reading of this record in this case is that Mr. Costello was moving. In fact, the last thing he was seen doing was moving. And we know this. We know that the position of the motorized device changed. So I would respectfully submit that the facts of the Hoffner case are far more egregious, that a driver didn't even see or know what he struck when he struck a person over 200 pounds and had to go back and figure that out, whereas this driver is going below the speed limit, is dealing with someone who's been last seen operating his device in a very erratic fashion, slams on the brakes, or
who
tries to do something.
Who slams on the brakes?
You're Rich.
What's the evidence of braking?
Her statement to the police.
Well, the trial judge obviously didn't believe that, including a lot of other things she said. She was drunk, sleep-deprived, and not looking where she was going, and there were no skid marks.
On the skid mark question, the problem is that there's nothing in the evidence, because it wasn't raised by the Commonwealth and therefore it wasn't rebutted, that this car was an anti-lock brakes car. And we know that now all cars are issued with anti-lock brakes. They don't leave skid marks. Of course, I'm talking outside the record because I'm having to disprove something the Commonwealth didn't prove. The Commonwealth put on nothing about her car, nothing about whether skid marks are left by anti-lock brake cars. None of that was introduced. So here we are on this record, and I'm having to argue about what the Commonwealth didn't do and try to prove something that wasn't proved.
There's no evidence that the absence of skid marks, of the absence of skid marks?
Right. There was the evidence, there was the argument about the absence of skid marks. Initially, the Commonwealth pointed that out as a basis for conviction, as a piece of the puzzle. On brief, at the trial court level, it was argued that the Commonwealth didn't put on any evidence to rebut, and that's totally improper for them to raise it at this time. You can't say an absence of skid mark evidence when you didn't introduce anything about the car equates to a failure to brake. The Commonwealth, at least impliedly, gave up on that point, made no argument to the trial judge any further about absence of skid mark evidence. Only on appeal was that revived. Only then does it make its way into the Court of Appeals memorandum opinion. But we would respectfully suggest that it's improper for the Commonwealth to fail to introduce evidence on that topic, to talk about the qualities of this car and whether or not it would have been expected that it would leave skid marks, so that the defense would have had an opportunity to rebut that. Nothing came up during the trial about
Didn't
that.
Didn't the trial court find that your client failed to brake?
That was based apparently on the initial argument on brief by the Commonwealth.
But the trial court made that finding. You raised an assignment of error to the Court of Appeals with regard to whether the trial court's findings were proper. Court of Appeals found that they were. You don't re-raise that to us, so isn't that settled with regard to this case? Aren't those facts set?
I would argue not. The Court of Appeals declined to review that issue. But the breaking evidence is and always was a part of our argument on the other two assignments of error, one having to do with causation, one having to do with criminal negligence. And so it was essentially a redundant third assignment.
Well, is it a redundant third assignment? You raise all of the factual findings that the trial court made in that assignment. Court of Appeals declines to address it. You don't raise it to us, so doesn't that mean that for purposes of our review, that those are the facts of this case because you didn't assign error to them to us?
We assign error saying that the that there is insufficient evidence to support both causation and the criminal negligence findings. And we've been consistent throughout from the trial court through the Court of Appeals.
That these are the facts and they're insufficient to support causation or negligence.
What we argued is that there is insufficient evidence of some facts existing at all and that those facts put together, the supposed facts, do not combine to show causation or criminal negligence.
The problem is the assignment that you didn't appeal is the factual predicate. And assignments that you did preserve are simply, okay, with this fact pattern, does it legally establish criminal negligence for DUI maiming, and does it legally establish a sufficiency argument for causation? But the factual predicate is not one and two assignment of error. A factual predicate is three, and that is law of the case.
Let me go at this a different way. Let's suppose for the sake of argument that the court believes based on this record that the trial judge did not make a mistake with regard to a finding that she failed to break. How do we know that breaking would have made any difference anyway? We don't know what Mr. Costello did. We're right back to square one. You put on your brakes when you have a reasonable opportunity to see someone and avoid that person. We don't know. And I challenge the Commonwealth to explain. What did Mr. Costello do? Was it a period of 2 seconds or 30 seconds? How did the trial court come up with whatever the period of time is? What did Mr. Costello do? I think that is really the fundamental problem here. That is the major weakness in the Commonwealth's case. And I see that I'm running out of time. If I may, reserve for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Chris Chandler for the Commonwealth. The only way that Rich can prevail in this appeal is if she convinces this court to read the facts in the light most favorable to her. Now, that is what she attempted to do at the trial level. That's what's appropriate there. That's what she attempted to do in the Court of Appeals, and that's what she attempts to do again in this court.
Counsel says even if those facts are settled facts for this case, how do we know what Mr. Costello did that he didn't turn into her at the last minute? How do we know what he did from the record?
Right, and I think what opposing counsel's argument boils down to is, in a case like this, unless you have a video of the accident or an eyewitness standing on the street corner watching the entire accident unfold, then there can never be a conviction. And that, of course, is not and should not be the standard. Instead, the standard is what reasonable inferences could have been drawn from the proven facts. In this particular case, a reasonable inference, and I would submit the most reasonable inference from the facts that we have from Ms. Young's testimony and from Ms. Rich's account of what happened, is that the victim in this case was crossing the street in a wheelchair, in a motorized scooter, that he had made it across two lanes of traffic, and he made it into the middle of this four-lane boulevard with this center lane with kind of like some turning area when Ms. Young left him, and that he continued operating the scooter in that direction towards the other side of the street, and had just entered that fourth and final lane next to the trailer park where he was headed when Ms. Rich's car struck him. The front left side of her car hit the right side of his motorized scooter, as that photograph that's in the evidence demonstrates. So the most reasonable reading of that is that he simply continued to cross the street, and that is the point at which he was struck. And from that evidence,
is there any dispute about what lane he was in when he was struck?
I don't believe that there's any dispute about what lane he was in. Ms. Rich was in the far right lane, the lane closest to that trailer park, which was the last lane that he had to cross before he got to the trailer park. And that is where he was struck, having just entered that lane. Now, on those facts, the reasonable inference is that he had been in the middle of the street in the lane directly to the left of Ms. Rich's lane, and then finally crossed into her lane, all as she is approaching him. Under that reading of the facts, again, the most reasonable reading of the facts, she should have seen him. And so her reckless inattention to the road, her sleep deprivation, her intoxication were a proximate cause that caused that accident. You would have to come up with this argument about, well, he may have turned in at the last moment. I guess the hypothesis there is that, well, maybe he was just cruising along the left lane and then turned in at the last minute into her right lane, and that's when he was hit. Even assuming that may have been what happened, still, her inattention to the road was a cause of that accident, because she should have seen a motorized scooter in the left lane directly next to hers in time to slow down and stop.
But isn't all the evidence, in fact, that his scooter was going generally perpendicular to the lines of vehicular traffic?
Correct, Your Honor.
So I've been trying to think all along of what is the scenario wherein he could possibly have been a cause. And so in order for us to visualize what you're talking about, he would have had to turn 90 degrees and been going parallel and then again turn right in order to be generally perpendicular. And
right.
There's no evidence at all.
Correct. There's some evidence that he was at a slight angle, so not completely perpendicular, maybe at an angle heading towards the other side of the street.
But generally going from left to from one side of the street to the
correct,
other,
Your
although
Honor.
Maybe not in a straight line.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that's the most reasonable read of the evidence, and that supports the conviction here. I also worked hard to come up with a theory, a hypothesis that might support innocence. I think it's complicated by the fact that he's in a wheelchair. So there are some civil cases where there is no idea in the record as to how the victim was injured. If there were no idea from the evidence of how this wheelchair got in the middle of the street, then perhaps we'd have a different case. But by the fact that he's in a wheelchair, he could not have sprinted from the sidewalk out into the front of the car at the last moment. He was in a motorized wheelchair driving across the street. I've thought of the possibility of a helicopter dropping the wheelchair in the middle of the street. I mean, there are no reasonable hypotheses that would make him the sole cause of this accident. I think the only thing approaching a reasonable hypothesis would be if he had somehow made it to the other side of the street and then for some inexplicable reason turned around to go back the other way, but then at the last possible moment had executed a U-turn and then gone back towards the street where he was initially headed, and that's where he was struck. And if he had been doing all of that, first that theory was not proposed, and if he had been doing all of that in the road in front of her as she approached, she should have seen him, and her driving behavior was the cause. You cannot say that his could have been the sole cause, which is what's necessary in the case.
What about the ABS and the braking? What's your response to all that?
In Stevens versus Commonwealth, as a court of appeals case decided in 2004, the court held as reasonable for a fact finder to conclude from the absence of any skid marks.
I mean, the facts established there were no brake marks.
Correct, right? Your Honor.
So then the question is, I mean, she said she braked.
Right.
But that the trial court could have discounted. So then we're left with, well, the modern vehicles are ABS. You know, have ABS, and that may affect skid marks and all that, but that's all, we don't have any of that in the record, so I'm trying to figure out what we do with it.
Right, so first of all, that's correct, we don't have that in the record, so that might be a hypothesis of innocence that was not made at trial and thus cannot be made here. That's the citations to, I guess, some online, some websites were made the first time on appeal and not at trial. But not just from the absence of skid marks can you conclude that she failed to brake. You can conclude that, or a reasonable fact finder could conclude that, from the first two versions that Ms. Rich gave of what happened. It was in her, I think, fourth and final version that she finally said, I looked away only for 1 second, then I looked up in time to see him and slam on the brakes. The first version that she gave that we see in the record is at page 20 of the appendix. And there, this is Officer Reese, is asked, did you hear the individual at the scene making any statements? He says, yes. She stated that she looked down for only a second and didn't, this is at page 47, my apologies. She stated she looked down for only a second and didn't see the scooter. That was the second version that she gave. The first version was at page 20.
So let's stop right there. A
yes,
fact finder could decide, you know what, I've heard this whole case and that's what I believe happened.
Yes. That
and out of the words of the defendant herself.
Correct, Your Honor. She did not see the scooter because she looked down, looked away, and that is what caused the accident. And so that avoids kind of the, you know, what do we do with, you know, whether she had anti-lock brakes or not. By her own initial statement, she did not see the scooter, and she struck the scooter. For that reason, she was a proximate cause. The evidence was sufficient as to that.
Do we have any cases, or a long line of cases, that address
gross, willful, and wanton negligence. Do we have any cases that approximate these facts?
I think the best cases that approximate these facts, Davis versus Commonwealth, which is the Court of Appeals case that I cited, where the victim was actually lying in the road and the defendant was intoxicated and sending text messages. And the question was the defendant's intoxication a sole proximate cause or a proximate cause of the injuries of running over that victim lying in the road? And the court there said that, yes, a fact finder could conclude that because he was intoxicated, he did not notice the victim lying in the road, even though his passenger noticed the victim lying in the road. And thus, his intoxication was a proximate cause of that accident.
There is a case, Baker versus Marcus, and you may not or may not be familiar with it, but there was alcohol involved.
Yes, sir.
Driver failed to keep a proper lookout, glanced away, and we held that wasn't enough. This seems awfully close to that.
That case sounds familiar in my research, but just based on the fact there was alcohol involved, I don't know what her BAC was, the glancing away. I did see several cases in the case law where the glancing away was the defendant had looked in the back seat briefly to because the person in the back seat had made a joke and then looked back. There was a defendant who looked to the passenger side of the car because her child was on the seat.
We don't just have glancing. We have
correct, coverage, Your Honor.
But it seems that the cases where we have found that there was a sufficient level of willful and wanton were much more egregious.
And those cases draw a distinction between a momentary glance away and an intentional looking away that's more prolonged than that. And I think a reasonable fact finder in this particular case could conclude that someone with a BAC of 0.13 leaning forward in her seat to allow her passenger, who is extremely intoxicated, more intoxicated than she is, to light her cigarette, would have taken more than one Mississippi. That's kind of the argument on appeal, is that they accomplish all of that in the time it takes to say one Mississippi in only 1 second, based on her statement. A reasonable fact finder could conclude it took much longer than that, so it's more than just a momentary glancing away, and that is why her behavior amounts to contributory negligence. Plus, you have the sleep deprivation of 18 hours on only 2 hours of sleep.
Well, another difference, although the drivers are driving at different speeds, according to the evidence, but you have someone who is driving, who does see him, who does stop, who even remonstrates with him, look, it's, you know, you need to be careful. So, although she said she was driving more slowly than the speed limit, this defendant didn't say she was driving very fast. I mean, she said she was driving the speed limit. So we have a situation where one driver sees him, stops, all that, and the other doesn't. And
correct,
so you have that contrast in this case, which we don't have in some of these other cases.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would submit that it should have been easier for Rich to have seen the victim driving across the street than it was for Young to see him. Because in Young's instance, he was merely coming off the sidewalk right to the right of her lane of travel. And in Miss Rich's instance, he should have been in the middle of the street, crossing the street in front of her. So whereas Miss Young would have been having to pay attention to the sidewalk beside her, and fortunately she was, all Rich had to do to avoid hitting him was just pay attention to the road in front of her. And she failed to do that. And Miss Young also said that if she had been driving more quickly, she thinks that she would have seen him, that she could have seen him. I just want to make one final point, and I'm happy to rest on my brief. I have not heard, there have been a lot of civil cases cited in this case. I have not heard a single case cited where opposing counsel believes the facts of that case are factually analogous to this case. Those cases have been cited mainly for general principle that...
We cited the Hoffner case?
Yes, Your Honor. So that case was cited specifically this morning. I wanted to address that case very quickly. In that particular case, the victim was run over while he was lying in the road parallel with the lines of the road, the line on the shoulder. He was 1 foot and 8 inches from that shoulder line, lying parallel with that shoulder line, when he was run over. And there was no testimony in the record anywhere as to how he may have gotten there, 1 foot and 8 inches from that shoulder line, lying perpendicular with it, when he was struck with the right tire of the defendant's car. And so the theories that were kind of brought forth by the court in saying that was not sufficient is that he could have been lying on the shoulder and then rolled into the road at the last possible second in an effort to commit suicide. And in that case, he would have been the sole proximate cause of that accident. And that was a reasonable hypothesis that was not in any way rebutted by the evidence. In this case, there's just no way to get this man in a motorized scooter in her lane of travel, on the left side of her lane of travel, in such a way that would make him the sole cause of that accident. So for that reason, that Hoffner case is kind of facially distinguishable. And so for all of these reasons, unless there are any further questions from the court, I will rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. I've got four things I hope to get through very quickly. At JA 29, you have the testimony of Ms. Young, who explains when she last saw Mr. Costello, he was, quote, towards the middle of the street at an angle partially pointed east towards the oceanfront, partially pointed south across the street. So she last saw him, and he was at an angle. At that point, at some way or another, he ended up moving his direction and ended up pointed due south. What we don't know is how long it took him to move, or whether he went first left, straight east towards the ocean front, and then right, or what he did. We just don't know, based on this record. The second point I wanted to make has to do with the speed and the ability to see this individual. Ms. Young testified she was driving 15 to 20 miles an hour in a 35 zone. She also testified that while she didn't have difficulty seeing him under the circumstances, she was concerned that anybody else driving faster might hit him. And that's the point. When Rich came along driving closer to the speed limit, but yet under it, she didn't see him in time to avoid hitting
him. What about the fact, though, that Young sees him in her rearview mirror being hit and flying in the air by the other driver? So she sees him in her rearview mirror, and the other driver doesn't see him head on?
So what Ms. Young, who had already had concern, I think the reasonable inference from this record is that she was paying attention, looking in her rearview mirror to see what this guy was going to do next. She's driving 15 or 20 miles an hour west away from him while a car's going the other direction at 30 miles an hour. That gap's going to grow very quickly, and then she sees the accident occur. What she doesn't know is where he went, what path he took,
and
nobody
else
does either.
But Ms. Young is not drunk. Ms. Young is not sleep-deprived, and Ms. Young is not getting a cigarette lit by her passenger, who's also drunk, and Ms. Young is looking, whereas your defendant was not looking, would have seen nothing, according to her own statement to the police. She didn't see a thing. She ran over him, never saw him. So the differences between Ms. Young and Ms. Rich are dramatic. I don't know how the two can be equated.
And we don't think they ought to be equated. That's really our point. Our point is that it's an unfair comparison to have someone who's driving half the speed limit, who is being unusually cautious in her own testimony because she's driving an unfamiliar car, and then to compare that with someone driving closer to the speed limit where we don't know what Mr. Costello did next. That's not a fair comparison. The other thing I wanted to point out having to do with the cigarette argument I just heard is that the trial judge explicitly said at JA 179 that the evidence was uncontradicted, that she looked down briefly to the right. The mistake we believe the court made is it then said that's automatically negligent as a matter of law. That means anything doing in your car other than looking straight ahead would be automatically negligent as a matter of law, and that's not the law, and the cases don't say that. Another case that I think is highly analogous, discussed with some detail in the Hoffner case, is the McManama case from 1981. You have a pedestrian who tried to cross the road and was killed, and the evidence failed to show whether this individual was standing or running when he went into the roadway, and you had a verdict that was reversed because the plaintiff failed to show how the accident occurred. And the court specifically rejected piling inference upon inference. And I respectfully submit that that's what this case here today is. It's intoxication plus a series of inferences that should not be piled on top of each other to get to criminal negligence and causation.
Intoxication, sleep deprivation, and not paying full time and attention plus inferences.
On the sleep deprivation, may I answer this question?
Absolutely.
On the sleep deprivation point, I would like to just make this emphatic point in response. There is no evidence that at the time of driving the car, she exhibited any signs of fatigue. In fact, there is no evidence that she ever exhibited any signs of fatigue in any of her interactions with the police and for hours afterwards. She simply made one comment, and that's the totality. That's a scintilla, but a scintilla shouldn't be enough.
All right, thank you very much. Call the next case.